Okay, first, just show where I am at and, who are my collaborators. So our approach is through patent discovery. I'll tell you exactly what I mean and some statistics on the patents that we discovered. Yeah, but this is just I don't want to write down my name and I do want to put this transparency on. This is not mine, so this is a I can't, I'm allowed to do this. For those of you who was here for the this is I stole from Steve Alshul's transparent if I don't know if you still recognize this. This is he put this down. Yeah, as you know, Steve Alshul is the one which develops the BLAST and CyBLAST to the sequence alignment. I try to draw an analogy between that and our approach. Along the same line that he did this. He did, So he asked the question, what is one trying to find, within this data, be it the sequence data or the, microarray data? And what algorithm that you have to develop to accordingly to find those things that you're trying to find? And then you will have to say, well, can the result be explained purely by chance? Say, how do you evaluate its statistical relevance? And generally, I think this is also very, very true. Keep that in mind that this tension between biologically reasonable definition of a problem and tractable algorithm and statistics. So you want to define the problem as precise as possible, but sometimes if you define it too precise, the algorithm that you it's impossible to develop. Okay, so some of the reason to have a particular algorithm is basically because of convenience and application. And he said he used some example of breast cancer genes to illustrate the power of CyBLAST also. So okay, so that's basically the line that I'm gonna use. So what we're trying to find? It's very simple. Well, I think you know already what a gene expression, so I don't have to get to the details of what is a gene expression. And basically, we are given a matrix, and I'll draw a matrix of certain size. And I'll draw it differently from all the other people, but because I want to have a parallel with the sequence analysis. So each of the rows of this matrix is a particular experiment or sample or cell. Okay, that's the row. And each column of this matrix is a particular gene that you probe. Okay. So on this axis, you could have up to, I don't know, most of the data we're dealing with is affine matrix data. So on this axis, you have, what the current data we have is 12K, it's 500 genes around. Okay. And the number of samples or experiment you do, as you heard this morning, is around, tens, 50, up to 100. Okay. So basically, we try to find pattern in this matrix. Okay. So, and you can look at this matrix in two different ways, obviously. You can look at the genes. And you say, let's cluster the genes according to expression across all the experiments. You look at the columns and try to cluster them together. And the idea there is that if two genes behave similarly across a lot of experiment, then their function might be similar. So that's sort of, if you look at column-wise, that would be in the realm of gene annotation. So if you suppose you don't know the function of a gene, by that way you can have a hint of what that gene is related to. What we are trying to do is looking at the rows, saying what's in common. Suppose all these experiments, all this matrix are composed of all the samples from all the cancer patients. And I also give you another matrix, let's say it's the control, which are all the normal samples. So that this other matrix will have the same dimension in the number of columns, so you're using the same probe, right? But you probe all the normal ones, a ensemble of normal cells. So the question that we ask is that now we have a new Okay, so this is normal. And this is, again, genes. So the question we are asking is that now you have a new sample come in, for example, a new unknown potential patient come in and did this chip. And the question is whether it belongs to this bucket or this bucket. Simple as that. It's a classification problem. But the way people do that, there are many ways to do that. This falls into the so-called supervised, category of in terms of methodology, because these guys all have the particular disease, and these guys don't, and you have that knowledge up front. So this is a train. You can use that to train your system, the algorithm, to identify an unknown, a new sample. Okay, again, there are many methods, and I'm not going to enumerate all of them. A lot of people here actually experience with that. I can roughly categorize, there's one method, there's one category of method which is presented in this, basically the method being used, for example, a typical one would be the one used this morning in the original colon cancer paper. So you actually don't use the knowledge up front. You don't use the knowledge that these guys have cancer, these guys don't. You mix them together and you cluster all the experiment. Okay, and then you look at your cluster. What you should find is that after you cluster them, you find this one particular cluster which consists of solely of one particular kind, say cancer. Then you say, aha, I find a cluster which corresponds to this particular disease, so I can use that as my diagnostic tool. Okay, so you don't use that knowledge up front that you already know this. And there are other methods which does use that knowledge. So as a physicist, the first thing you would do is that, what are the genes that are responsible in distinguishing these two classes, gene by gene, individual gene by gene, right? So you can look at all the genes, all the, 12,000 genes, and evaluate its correlation with this particular phenotype one by one, and select those that's highly correlated with this particular disease. That also has been done in the literature. It was first done in the lymphoma cases, distinguished ALL, AML, for those who knows that, two different kinds of lymphoma, and people has done experiment on these two classes, and what they did was looking at each genes to identify those highly indicative genes and use them as a diagnostic tool. Once you have a new sample come in, you just say which class it belongs to. So that's sort of gene by gene method. And should I have to write this down? And so first is sort of I will call it indirect method. So you don't use that knowledge, beforehand. And there's another class method, which is basically I would call a poor man's method. It's gene by gene. So the pitfall of this one is that you ignore totally the correlation between genes. There may be one gene or couple of genes that highly differentiate between the two classes. Then you find it. Once you find it, the problem is solved. But in cases you have a class of genes going up and down coherently, then you might be missing that signal. Okay. So the third one is sort of the machine. You can use neural network, but people preferred way to do this in that category is so-called SVM, supporting vector machine. What it is that now you're looking at a bunch of points. So if you imagine each experiment is a point in a high dimensional space, the dimensionality of the space is basically this 12,000 genes. So you imagine a bunch of points in a high dimensional space. One set of points is red, one set of points is black, correspond to two different phenotypes. And you try to separate them. And so the simplest way, this is oversimplification, but that's the spirit of SVM, is that you have all these black dots. and you have all these hollow dots. In some high-dimensional space, this is purely very simplified picture. And the way SVN separates this thing is trying to come up with a hyperplan which separates this thing. Now, there are many, many choices. You can put down the hyperplan to separate these two set of dots. But the SVM chooses the one which maximizes the minimum distance from each group to the plan. So I'll draw two plans. One is like this. So from each group, the minimum distance from that group to the plan is defined. So you want to maximize that. So this plan is definitely better than this one, where the minimum distance is shorter than here. So you choose one that maximizes the minimum distance. And it's very logical, very intuitive way. And this is just and also you can play with the kernel so that your separating plan don't have to be a plan. It can be any curve that you desire. But that's a choice you have to make. But once you made that choice, you can come up with a simple algorithm, iterative algorithm, to make that, to do that. And this, the reason it's called supporting vector machine is that, as you see, this plan, suppose we choose this plan, is only determined by a very few number of points in the group. So if I put this one, doesn't affect the position of this plan, even though it can move this dot a little bit, it won't change this. So this plan is supported, so to speak, by a number of elements from each group. There's a supporting vector machine. So once you identify such a separating plan, then a new point coming, you can just say if it belongs left or right or whatever, then use that as a characterization scheme. Okay? So that's that. There are many, many more methods, but this seems to be used quite often in the literature by various people. Okay. So what is our approach? So that's come to the first one. What is one trying to find? What are we trying to find? Okay. What are we trying to find? First of all, this approach is all fine, but its limitation is pretty obvious. For example, take SVM. It's like a black box, right? You give it two sets of data. It finds the separate checks. It probably can do a very good job in distinguishing the two classes, but it won't tell you exactly why it's doing that, how it does that. For example, you want to know which of the genes that's responsible to separate these two. Then it's very hard to get that information out of the black box. I think it's the same with neural net type of approach. You don't know very well. Also, I mean, you are using all the dimensions. Remember, these points live in a high-dimensional space. The dimension could be as high as 12K. And it's very easy to overfit the data by, you know, it's very easy to put a plan down to separate these two set of points in a high-dimensional space. I also said the limitation here is you may be missing some important correlation. And indirect, if it works, it's great, but you sort of not fully using the knowledge here. So what are we trying to do here? What we're trying to do is trying to find patterns. Okay, our primary goal is not clustering. If the pattern we find lends itself to cluster different scenes, that's fine. But we're just trying to find a pattern which is significant. Let me just go on to define what I mean by a pattern. Okay. So we're trying to find a pattern. Suppose this is all the cancer cell experiments, right? We're trying to find a pattern here. What do we mean by a pattern? We mean mathematically is we have, this is a huge matrix, okay? So by a pattern we mean, this is hard to draw. Can I show one transparency? It's a sub-matrix. Basically, we say, well, we can select a subset of genes. If we can select a subset of genes here, here, and here, so let me just highlight these boxes. And even subset of experiment, this pattern doesn't have to cover all the experiment. It can cover a significant amount of all the experiment, but it's not a requirement to cover all the experiment. So my, basically in terms of this matrix is that I can, my pattern is a sub-matrix of this huge matrix, which is selecting a subset of genes. And also I select a subset, not select, but just this pattern covers a subset of experiments such that this submatrix So identify the submatrix. The submatrix has the property that, you know, this gene within that submatrix, this colon within that submatrix, all behave similarly. So this might be high, this three box, this might be low, this might be somewhere in the middle, but they have to be all consistently in a narrow range. So that's what we define as a pattern. Okay? So that's why I finished the first part, the definition. The logic behind it is pretty simple, namely, well, the number of genes that's relevant for a particular phenotype is probably a very, very, very small subset of these 12,000 genes. So you don't want to cluster, use a cluster algorithm to use all the genes to cluster, because that would dilute your signal significantly. The reason for having a pattern which contains only a subset of experiment or samples the reason for that is that it could, within a big phenotype, you could have subphenotype, right? So a subset of this patient may share something that's not shared by the all the members, okay? But if there is a pattern which is shared by all the members, we're not forbidden that. I mean, this can be all the experiment, but we're not excluding the kind of pattern which only extend over a subset of all the samples. Okay, we just cover our bases. So this is what I define as pattern. Okay, algorithm. The way we do that is actually I'm not going to tell you about the algorithm because it's not I didn't do it and was IBM has a big effort in data mining and the algorithm of those kind, and we just readily borrow those. And also, we have, before gene expression array came out, we have a lot of effort in looking at sequence alignment. So that okay. So the algorithm basically is high. If you look at the problem just by it is, and you say, well, this is an exponentially hard problem, right? You have you don't know a priori which of the genes you select. You don't know a priori which experiment to select, right? But it turns out it's not that hard. You could probably find a problem which is exponentially hard, but a typical problem is not like that. So basically, you do is you build hierarchically. First, you look at the pairs, and then you look at triples, and so on. You build up, and the tree, that never dies, the tree will grow exponentially. That's the exponential part of the danger. But actually, what will happen is the tree will truncate after a while and dies, because you won't find many, many, many huge patterns. After a while, the number of patterns you find will decrease. Okay, that's all I need to say about this algorithm. I mean, anybody interested in the algorithm, you can talk about it later, but. The algorithm in its form, in the sequence form, is published, and the part that you can use in microarray is pretty straightforward modification of that. Okay, so that's the analogy on a jaw. So the reason on a jaw is in this peculiar way, to sort of usually when you look at microarray data, experiment is always the colon and the row is always the genes. The reason on a jaw in this way is that I wanted you to think each experiment as a sequence. Okay, each experiment is a sequence where each position of the sequence corresponds to the gene expression level of this particular gene. So you can think of a sequence going up and down. You know, this is a sequence. You try to align. What we're doing is nothing but trying to do a multiple alignment between all these experiments. Well, you say, oh, the alignment is given. You know, you can't shift into the gene, right? It's true, but the alignment is given. But which gene is included in that alignment, it's not given. So it's a very peculiar kind of multiple alignment, if you wish. So that's the reason I want to... So just trying to make an analogy with Steve Alshu. I think what we're all doing here is basically developing tools to search for patterns. So this is how we define it, and the way we look for it, I don't want to talk about it. And now the statistic part. Once you find such a particular pattern, how do you evaluate statistical relevance? For that, I have to tell you exactly, you know, quantitatively, what do we call a pattern? Okay, so at least the first part, is it okay? I mean, since this is a discussion, is it okay up this, to this point? Okay, good. Now. So in order to do any kind of comparison, I said, you know, just, you know, the pattern, by pattern I mean the column that I choose, the gene I choose, within the experiment I choose, has to stay in a range. This is a very vague statement. I need to put more, quantify that statement, right? So let's look at a gene by gene basis. So what do I mean that this column is a good column? What do I mean? This column with this selected box is a good column. What do I mean by that? Roughly, you know, it has to be consistent. It has to be in the narrow range. But what do we mean by that? Okay, you have to come up with, basically you have to come up with a metric. How do you measure distances, right? Remember that the goal here is to separate two groups, right? So I haven't told you how did I use this matrix. I'm saying all we're doing is finding pattern in this matrix, in the matrix that contains all the cancer samples. So how do we use that? We have to use this because we're trying to distinguish this from this, right? So let's look at the gene by gene basis. How do we do that? So the naive way we do it would be just look at the fold differences, right? How many fold is changing. But we thought we can do a little bit better because since we have a sample size, we have a sort of distribution. We should take into account the spread of the data, both because there is natural spread of data and also because there's error, there's noise in the data. Okay? So let me just draw one scene. So for a particular gene, let's take one gene. Let's look at its expression level in the control, in the normal sample. Okay? If you look at, you know, a lot of these things, they mostly form some, if you take the log of that number, then and you plot the distribution versus, you know, because you have more than one sample, you have, you know, 10 or 20 samples. You can roughly draw a distribution, and that distribution is basically something like this. It has a peak and it has a spread. So that's your background distribution, let's say. And this is the low end, this is the high end. The control of the normal cells. The distribution, this is the expression error, expression for gene I, E of I. And this is the distribution of E of I of control, or, you know, normal cell. Let's put an end here. Okay? You can argue whether we can come up with a reasonable distribution with given number of samples, but let's suppose we can, okay? So that's the distribution. Now, I have two samples from the phenotype, okay? They can be here, these two samples. These are two values from a phenotype. These are two values from this matrix. Okay? Let's call it X1, Y1. With the same number of fold in between them, okay? And now you have a next set of X2, Y2. The question here is how do we come up with a metric to measure distance? Suppose the natural one is to take the log and you use the Euclidean distance, just the difference, no? Okay. But is it good or not in this particular context? I'll argue it's not. Because if, even though X1, Y1, X2, Y2, the distance is the same, I would say I would rather cluster these two guys together. And I don't want to cluster, I mean, this is, I would say, closer in some sense, in terms of distinguishing this from the distribution. Because it's really, really that the control or the normal cells express down here. Whereas if you are here, the normal cells actually have a lot of probability to occur there. There's a lot of confusion going on there. So okay, here's what it is. I want to construct a metric M of X and Y. X and Y are the log of the expression measurement. Okay. And the naive way would just be X minus Y. Okay. What I'm saying is that I want to take into account the control, the normal cell distribution into account. I would rather define the metric as integration of X to Y, probability of N, S, dS. Okay? Oh, yeah, yeah. I think it does, yeah. But this is not, if you look at this, I did it sort of more complicated, but if you think of intuitively, what it is that you're trying to compare some number with some non-uniform background, right? If the background is uniform, you don't have to do this song and dance and come up with a different metric. So another way to look at it is that you want to transform this guy so that the transformed variable has a uniform distribution. And that amounts to exactly the same thing as doing like this. So now you have a variable y, and now mu is basically equals minus infinity to x p of n of s ds mu of x. Your new variable mu, if you look at the distribution function in the normal one, will be just a uniform distribution between 0 and 1. Right, and you transform this x and y accordingly, and you get the distance like this. Okay. So that's how we define our metric. The definition of metric, the goodness about that is twofold. One is that after this transformation, in the new variable, you just use the Euclidean distance. That's okay, because your background is uniform. The second nice thing about it is in the transformed variable, your background or your control is a uniform distributed number between 0 and 1. So you can do a lot of statistics on the control matrix, because now your control matrix, all the elements are between 0 and 1, and uniformly distributed for each of the genes. Sorry? This one? They're transforming X to mu. Okay. Right. So basically what I'm saying is that this is basically mu of x minus mu of y. So I don't use this. Right. Yeah, so okay, so that's the thing. Suppose you're already lowly expressed. I don't care how lowly you expressed, you are lowly expressed. Suppose you're way out here, and then tenfold, and then thousandfold, and 10,000-fold, I take it as the same. So that's sort of a ranking type of distance, right? You're basically looking at the percentile, the ranking, basically taking into account the breadth of the distribution, not the absolute differences between the center. Yeah, that's all points that we'll take. I mean, this is the metric designed to look at, you know, differentiate here to here. But if, you know, you find some application, but you can always look back. I mean, after you find the pattern, you can always look at the original value to see, you know, if there's something you're interested in as a post-processing type. So again, this is here, right? There's always a tension between, the tension is, yeah, so. Yeah, if you don't take the log, the distribution is kind of awkward. It doesn't, but you don't get a nice distribution. I mean, as it is, the number of data points to construct a distribution is already pushing it. You really need. Oh yeah, okay, that's a good point. If you just want to order your value, you probably don't care. That taking the log doesn't matter. I mean, you get the same distance. But the way we did it is we try to take into account the data fluctuation also. So the way you said it, or the ranking part, is basically exactly like if you have n point as in your control, you approximate it, I mean, you take each point as a delta function and sum them up and you get the distribution. And that, if you translate, that will be exactly like a ranking. But we're not taking that approach. We say, well, each point, if you measure it at let's say 10, the measurement is not accurate, as we know. If you take the same sample, put on two different chip, the fluctuation is around twofold. So there's a very well-defined, you know, repeatability experiment you can do. So what we did was that at each point, we represent each point by a little Gaussian with the standard deviation given by the width of that distribution. So we do come up with a smooth distribution. And then, you know, from there.
Sorry, so this is the contribution of gene I.
Yeah, right.
So this has an index I on it.
Exactly.
So we just add these up over the mean to get the distance between two experiments?
No, we don't do, okay. We don't do a global, see, the way we do it is like a cubic box instead of a spherical box. So we don't calculate this. We have to satisfy criteria on each one of the axes. You know what I'm saying?
I get it.
Yeah. So yeah, but if you want to calculate distance, that what we would do. You know, that's what we would do. We don't put weight on, I mean. Okay. So that's how we decide our distance. So okay, so now we have a metric. We know exactly what we're looking for. And we have an algorithm which we refuse to tell you. And we can just go find all these patterns. And it's great, right? You find all the patterns. The problem there is then, well, how do you evaluate these patterns? Okay. So okay, so this is the metric. Can I erase this now? So the detailed way to define the metric, the pattern actually a little bit.
So just to make sure I understand the geometrical interpretation of this, forget the distance measures, I understand that you have a non-linear distance.
Right.
You have a cloud of points in some high-dimensional space.
Right.
So now you look for a subspace.
Exactly.
Of that high-dimensional space such right. that you project.
Yeah.
Onto that subspace, you find the column.
Yeah, exactly. Very good. So, let me rephrase. So, what we are doing is we have a little magnifying glasses of a cube of a hypercube of various dimensions. We just go into the space to find a region that has more than its fair share of points. If we find that, we say, haha, we find a region that's interesting. That's what we would call a pattern. And the pattern will consist of the point in that cube, hypercube, and the dimension of the hypercube. And the, you know, so that's what we're doing, basically. Okay, and the reason we can do that is after the normalization, everybody is in between 0 and 1 in the hypercube of, you know, unit hypercube, all the points, right? So you just... So okay, still, but when you find a pattern, so we define a delta valid. This is a little bit awkward. JK pattern, JK maximum pattern. So what do I mean by that? So we have this big matrix. This is the gene. This is samples, experiments. And it has a dimension of big N E, and has a dimension big N G, number of gene and number of experiments. And the pattern is defined as a submatrix in this big matrix, has dimension J and K. Wherein each column within the submatrix is delta, the distance, maximum distance between any two points of this column is delta or smaller. Okay, so that's delta valid. That's JK. What does it mean maximum? Maximum means that this pattern cannot grow anymore. Sorry? Yeah, it's reshuffled. Yeah. The particular order doesn't mean anything. Right? Yeah. So this pattern is here. Maximum means I cannot grow it anymore without violating my delta validness. So I cannot add a column or a row.
Is it also delta?
No. No, only Y, because each gene has to be consistently expressed between all the experiments. But it doesn't matter. I mean, this direction has no... I mean, the curve, if you... It doesn't have to be flat. In the column.
For a gene.
Right. Remember now, this is after I normalize it. So each column are all numbers between 0 and 1. Okay. So delta can be a small number. You can choose. But there are a lot of improvement you can think of. But let me just speak again, because of the easiness of presentation. Let me just say delta valid maximum JK pattern. That's how we define it. And this algorithm can actually go out and find them. And of course, you say, well, J has to be, you set some criteria. J has to be bigger than some N E mean. Minimum number experiment has to cover, and K has to be bigger or equal than some minimum number of genes that has to be contained in that pattern. So the size of the thing has to be bigger than something. Okay. So that's the definition, and then we go on to look at it. So the part of statistic is to say, suppose I find something like that. Suppose I find a delta valid JK maximum pattern. What is the statistical relevance of this? And this you can evaluate because, I mean, okay, this you can evaluate under the new hypothesis, which is, you know, may or may not be true. I'll tell you later why it's not. One thing is true, so the question you're asking is that, how often do you see such a matrix in the control? Right? The control, we know after normalization, are all numbers between 0 and 1 uniformly distributed, because the distribution of the new variable is a flat curve between 0 and 1. But given that, you can calculate the occurrence frequency for such an object. Okay. So you can analytically calculate that. And you can analytically evaluate the standard deviation. I don't know, maybe I didn't try hard enough, but I couldn't get the full distribution function. I can get the average value and get a two-point correlation function that corresponds to two pattern overlap. So basically calculate two-point correlation function. And I couldn't get the generating function. So, but I think for the purpose of evaluating the importance of the pattern, it's good enough. Yeah.
So single, you calculate the probability that a number that large or larger would appear in the control. How do you calculate the exact probability of a particular float from your submatrix is negligible?
No.
You must be doing something else.
No. Let me just try to. Okay, this is pushing my limit of blackboard writing. So what the statement that you're asking is that how often do you see such a matrix, such a submatrix, satisfy this criteria in a big matrix like this? So out front, you have big factors come in, like you have NE choose J. That's how many ways you can generate such a matrix. NG choose K. And remember, this NG is huge. NE can be, on the order of 50, 100. Right, that's the how many ways generate this matrix. And for each column to satisfy delta validness, I think it turns out to be this thing, j minus 1 minus j minus 1 delta j. You can calculate for each column what is the probability of having j numbers within the delta. The delta can be, the origin of the delta can be anywhere, but it doesn't have to be within delta. You can calculate that probability. This you can understand pretty easily. I mean, delta to j minus 1 basically means that you have to fix one, and the rest has to be within delta, so that's delta j minus 1. And this j basically is a sort of entropic contribution. So you can calculate that. And this one comes from the end effect. You have two ends. And raised to the power of k, right? And the maximality says you cannot extend the pattern. So these guys has to be 1 minus this probability. Let's call it p of j delta. P of j delta raised to the power of n g minus k. So that's maximality. And maximality in this direction is a little bit nastier. But you can also write down, right? I'm not going to write the full thing down. But you can calculate it. This is not... So, okay, can I show one? Just so, maybe I shouldn't, well. So basically, at the end of the day, you want to get some curve like this, right? This is your JK space. And if you land a point like here, you say it's the p-value is bigger than some threshold, and you say it is a significant pattern, you should take a look at it. So that's the whole point. Yeah, sure. Oh yeah, delta equals 0.1. This is for a particular example of ng, ne, and delta. Suppose you fix those, and then that's the figure. And if you increase delta, the curve will move up. Exactly. So that's a parameter you have to choose. So what delta basically is a measure of overlap between the two distribution. How much do you say? How much do you want to say that you're worth looking at each individual gene basis? 0.1 is what we choose as a default, but you can reduce that to 1%, or you can increase that to 15%. But this is a parameter you can tune. The experimentalists can tune. But you're right. I mean, there might be an intrinsic delta for each of the gene. But that's something I think it's sort of in the improvement part. But for now, the delta is a tunable value that's given. You can. Yeah, that's this. Basically, something I was trying to. I didn't finish, but along those lines. Which P? Oh yeah, this is pre-processing. After you processed all this thing, right? P. No, I don't. This is getting from real data. Yeah. Yeah. I don't assume anything. To how to get from finite number of points to a smooth distribution. That's a different. That's something you can play with. But once you get that, then in the transformed variable, this calculation is valid. Okay, where's my inspiration sheet? So the story is not end. I mean, now we can evaluate each individual pattern, but there's a bigger problem there, because patterns tend to overlap, and new pattern, not too individually important pattern. Relevant pattern doesn't mean they both mean informative, because they could have large overlap. Let me take the one example, just the way we construct the scene, right? So suppose you have one pattern like this. This is your good pattern within the big ocean of genes, and you find it somehow. The algorithm is not, just find everything. So algorithm will also find most likely some other pattern and a whole lot of other patterns. Basically, a cloud of pattern around here. What we'll find is something like this. Well, it sacrifices some experiment but added a new gene. Okay? It can also sacrifice some of the genes to add a new experiment, and so on and so forth. So you have to look at this cloud of pattern and decide what makes sense out of this. But the way we did that, at least the first step towards doing that, is looking at the correlation between patterns. Or in other words, you can cluster the patterns. That's the first time I mentioned cluster, I hope. So basically what you're saying is that given the presence of this yellow pattern, this green pattern is basically a variant. You know, if this exists, given that the rest genes are still there are 10,000 of them, there might be a random occurrence that slap on here that have this property that its value just randomly fall into this delta with a limited number of genes. Let me experiment. Okay, so this is just a random occurrence given. So basically what you have to calculate is a conditional probability between all the pairs of patterns you discover. You want to calculate basically the probability P of given pattern per psi 1, of given pattern per psi 2, and the probability per psi 1. If this number is bigger than some threshold, let's call it p-value threshold, let's call it point, let's say 0.01, some random threshold, then you say the occurrence of 1 per psi 1 is basically a variance of per psi 2. You know, if per psi 2 is there, per psi 1 is there with a high probability. And you just neglect psi 1. So by that, you clean up a lot of things. But you still don't clean up everything. So this is like, again, go back to the analogy between this and the blast. This is like you're finding those hits, and you still want to grow those hits a little bit so that you don't satisfy the exact constraint. So you grow a little bit to cover all the other part. And this is basically come from something like this. So this is this pattern, these green ones, comes about because the random fluctuation in the rest of the non-patented genes and experiment. There could be other cases where you have mutation or bad sample taking. Suppose within, you know, a priori this is a pattern, but somewhere, somehow, you made a mistake measuring this dot, and made a mistake measuring this dot. What's going to happen? What's going to happen is very bad, because if you made one mistake here, it moved to the corner, shuffled into the corner. What's happened is that the algorithm will find two patterns. Instead of finding one pattern, you'll find two. One is this, and one is excluding this gene, right? And you can just imagine once you make two mistakes in the big pattern, then you're going to get four patterns and so on. But they highly overlapped. So if you grow a little bit, each one of them, you will grow to the mother pattern, and there is everybody merged. Okay? So that's, you know, you have to do a lot of post-processing about the pattern to get to a meaningful ones. But still, I mean, this is not a definite, I mean, we haven't found a generating function of all the patterns. It's just some heuristic way to get to a handful set of patterns that's informative. So after all this said and done, then you're left with some big, hopefully more or less orthogonal patterns, which you can use then to do your classification or whatever you want to do. Yeah. Yeah, that's a good point. Yeah, that's a very good point in the sense that if we find our pattern, you know, to the left, to the right, biologists will say, boy, I understand why, because it's upregulated or downregulated. If it so happened in somewhere in the middle, but the reason you find it is because it's narrowly, you know, narrowly expressed. I don't know any biological, I mean, people, when we talk to biologists, Dan can, you know, I haven't tried this on Dan. People will say, oh, this is interesting, but I don't know any examples of that. It's interesting. I mean, maybe it means that you have to be narrowly regulated to be functional. If some network get loose and it then become fluctuating widely, and if you regulate it tightly, and it will be right in the middle and not very variable. It's possible, but I haven't found any. But that's just our algorithm that does that. If it indeed is that case, we will find it. The interpretation, we have to give it to biologists. Yeah. Yep. we can do that. Yeah, that's a good point. So we have an option to say, you know, don't look at any narrow delta valid region where the average is not at least twofold. You know, you can put that in, because that's basically a sort of the way algorithm works is that for each gene, it uses window to find the dots in the window, and then try to merge these combs to find a huge pattern, bigger pattern. So in the first step of finding the dots in the window, you can say, neglect those that you find in the middle of the background. Only take into account the ones that at 2n. Yeah. But the thing is, this is a statistically relevant statement event. It might be something in there. I mean, so I would have just that optional background there. I mean, I wouldn't totally erase that possibility of finding those. Yeah. So, okay. So that's basically the algorithm, and application-wise, we have tried it on various things with varying degrees of success, and I don't want to talk in detail about the particular example, because I'm not allowed to show anything, but I just say it. I mean, that in the case where you do have one clear separation between, you know, two phenotypes, our method do as good as any other method, because there's just one pattern there separate them. But in the case, let me just show you this is a synthesized data, but I think it might apply to many of the real biological system. Oh, let me just draw it. This I can draw, actually. Let me erase this. I suppose this is the matrix you have. Right? I'm saying if you do have one big, a set of genes which really behaves differently from its control, which means that you do find a big pattern expanding over all the examples, then even gene by gene method, SVM, whatever, will find it. No problem. Maybe all the biology falls into the category. I hope not. If it is a situation like this, suppose, you know, you do have a pattern which doesn't extend over all the samples, and you have another sample covering the other one third, and you have another pattern covering, they all have overlaps. There's some gene is in common between all these patterns, but maybe there's something disturbs the pathways, but the downstream effects could be different in different subgenotypes. It could be. In those cases, our method outperforms other methods, because we can just find these sub-patterns and use all of them, because these are all very significant statistically. We just find them and use all of them to identify new ones, and that's where the power is. So one of the cases that we tried and outperform SVM and gene-by-gene method is in the p53 cases, where this could be the case, because the mutation of p53, the downstream effect of p53 could be much, much more complicated than just one simple pathway. So if it causes something different, either at different stages of the cancer or different cancer have, you know, different pathway being disturbed after this gatekeeper, you know, get drunk, and in those cases, our method will outperform other methods. So basically, this method is very sensitive in detecting this more subtle signals. But if there is a big pattern there, we'll find it. But it's not unique of this method.
Did you say it does outperform?
It does outperform. In this case, it does outperform.
I mean, in the
P53 case. Yeah, in the P53 case, you're right.
It does outperform.
Right, yes, yes. Sorry? Yeah. No, but okay. So no, the thing is, that data set that we did on the P53 is the NCI60 data set. Okay, the NCI60 data set consists of 60 cancer cell lines, and among the 60 cancer cell lines, they are I believe 17 of them are mutated, p53 mutated. And the question is, how can you separate these two groups? Oh, the reference, you know. it's in ISMB, the last year's ISMB proceeding. I have a copy if you want. But that case might just it's one case. I mean, I don't want to swear with, you know, but I think theoretically this is what we know, is that in the case that you have multiple sub-patterns, no other method has performed as well as our method. But well, we don't know all the other methods, but the method we tried, SVM, a gene by gene method, or the indirect method, doesn't seem to work as well. Because for the reason that we can identify this pattern, and you know, that's the end of the story. Yep, so that's all I am telling. Thank you. But he will kill me. let's see. Never mind.
I'll just go make a copy. I'll bring it
right. Yeah, don't worry. Take it. I doubt it. Just take it. Okay. I definitely don't want to take it back to New York. That's.
Do you have an extra copy or?
I can send you a PDF file. I mean, okay. Yeah. It's in the context of sequence, it's called splash.
Splash.
Right. And this one we call genes at work or something like that. I was going to demo. You want to see the. No, look. This is what the dense data is doing on the computer for two seconds. So let me just get up this program. Notterman, right. You see, your name is prominently.
I recognize the pattern.
So we have collaborated with lymphoma and with lymphoma people at Columbia. So this is basically the. So you just load this file. So let's say p53 at cutoff 72%. That's.
Right. So this is the stuff I showed today.
Yeah, basically.
This little code is what you wrote, is it?
What is it saying? This is called genes at work. This is just the pattern discovery part of the stuff I talked about.
So this is like a code?
Yeah.
IBM?
Yeah. So this is, you know, you load all the 16 chips into here, and you select the criteria, which is p53 mutated, and that it finds 8 of them, p53 mutated. So all these are just experiments.
Nice.
And just each chip looks like that. It may not look like that in the real life, but that's
what the final cluster looks like.
Oh, well, but then you select criteria. Yeah. Delta is 10%, that's 0.21. And support, let's say, it's 6 out of whatever, 8.
You're
at least 6. Yeah, so you just say start. Find 37 patterns. And you click.
You want to show it? Yeah.
Yeah, click one of the patterns, and you just look at the condensed one. It's basically, you know, mm-hmm. It's not very impressive. Look at each one individual gene. The point is that it occurs simultaneously, so the compounded statistical relevance is high. That's, you know, 10^7. That's the value.
But why did you want to keep the lower ones, the expression low, very low, even though they occur simultaneously?
That's not.
No.
Those are not.
Well, it is. These ones are lowly expressed and these are highly expressed. So why not? The overlap is 10%.
And the black is.
What do you mean the overlap?
Just delta.
So that means the distance between any of these in here.
Is 0.1.
Is 10%.
Yeah, after the transformation, yeah. Right. So, and you can.
So, in other words, these genes have nothing to do with this cancer. Because they're not.
No,
expressed.
No, these genes
have.
No,
even they're
not.
Going down.
They're going.
The color means nothing. These go down, these go up.
Right.
Okay.
Right. This just. Visualize. So, you. Yeah, so if you click on any of this pattern, it will just show.
The happy hour.
And these are the genes that in that pattern. So if you look at this gene, indeed you see that on the left-hand side, which is, I think it's a wild type, a little bit lower than the right-hand side, right? The overlap is not, there's not much overlap. And you look at the.
No, that color does mean something. That's the expression level.
Yeah, 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 it's low and high.
You can't, by eye, tell how far apart.
No.
Well, they're very
close.
Like
in other
words, those are
lonely express.
Right.
Let's say these are the normal ones.
Yeah, that's if you have coloration, then we then this this.
And now these are sick ones.
Right.
Okay. After your okay, let's say they're already normal. This is 0-1,
yeah.
0-1. Okay.
Right. Right.
Okay. So these are normal, and these are the tumors.
Right.
Then this pattern.
Right.
Would come out to be non-significant, insignificant.
No. Why not?
Because it's like here. Well, it's the density of. Here you have a density. Well, now let's say it's uniform already. Because this is the density.
Right.
And this is the density here, right?
Right.
So. In this area, in such a large area, proportional should be, I don't know, 5 points. Well, if there are enough points in this, I mean.
No, but I would argue actually this is important. I will find this important, but you really shouldn't take it as important because even in the normal ones, you will find this. Okay.
This is important, but you won't say it's important. How come?
I would say it's important, but in fact, because my null hypothesis is that all these points, are uniformly distributed.
Yeah, but this is reasonable in the null hypothesis.
It's not.
Why not?
Well, this little box contains, you know, 5 dots where the area is.
No, let's say the 5 dots is the normal. 5 dots is like in a okay. This is the null hypothesis.
Mm-hmm.
Right?
Right.
So. Let's say this is 5 points,
right.
3 points. Okay.
Right.
So 3 points here.
Right.
Yeah,
if it's uniformly distributed, the rest, and if you put somewhere, yeah, it won't.
So this won't be fine, although it is significant.
Why is
look,
that?
All the normals are here.
Yeah, but
and this
okay.
Is here. So it's far away from the.
Yeah, okay. So if you have some correlations, you have correlations. Yeah, between genes.
So then your significant
right.
value is
exactly.
Not
oh, that point we also said in the paper.
Okay.
The null hypothesis is that they don't have correlation. But we do take that into account when we do classification, in the sense that we after we find these patterns, we actually evaluate not only its relevance, also it's called promiscuity, meaning that this pattern does it also include, so then you take all the control points and you say whether those points is close to the pattern or not. If it's they are points close to the pattern.
So, do you know about our work, this coupled to a clustering? Did you hear?
I wasn't here.
Okay, so actually that's not the same, but solve the same problem, like subsets of this and that.
Right.
So you could look at it and see.
Okay.
So whenever you know you
yeah.
have to talk about it, so see the difference.
Yeah.
So, okay. But I have to read the paper and to
sure.
Because I understood what you said.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
I have to. You know,
yeah, I think the need for such things is definitely there.
Yeah.
It's just, you know, like I always want to put this slides on because this slides mean the Steve Schuller really summarized really well. I mean, in terms of algorithm and reality, this is constant tension. I mean, you know if something is not reasonable in your model, but to change that
make
in the algorithm, make it complexity, you know, explode.
Yeah.
So you may want to do something like post-processing, you know, like repair the things that you know It's not reasonable. So that's what we do with the correlation part. Mm-hmm. It repairs some of
Yeah, actually we did also clustering of the clusters.
Right.
Thank you.
Sure. Are you convinced?
No, I want to know what I'm doing.
You're destroying my program, that's what you're doing.
I don't want to look at it.
2%, yeah.
2%. It's really close.
So it's really, really close, and you don't, and you look at, you know, what you...
How come there's nothing?
Did you... you erased the data?
I didn't do anything.
Well, never mind.
Whatever.
I think somehow the graphics... thinks all the points are all zeros.
I just want to see what a 1% looks
like. 1%?
Yeah.
You probably can't find too many. Let's load it again. 1%, you probably have to lower the support 2%. Level. 2%. No, you have to select the criteria, which means that you select the mutated one against the wild type.
Okay.
This is your control and this is your phenotype. Then you say, let's search, start, 6, it's probably, let's choose 4. 4 means this pattern has to contain 4 out of